Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this episode, to mark the 50th anniversary of the 1967 Detroit Rebellion, Seattle Public Library hosted a discussion of the factors that create inequality, repression, and resistance. Scott Kurashige is a professor of American and Ethnic Studies at the University of Washington, Bothell. He's the author of The 50-Year Rebellion, How the U.S. Political Crisis Began in Detroit. Michael Hart is a professor of literature and romance studies at Duke University. He is the author of Assembly. Kurashige and Hart spoke at the Seattle Public Library Central Library on August 16th. Nikita Oliver opened the event with her poem, Just Us. Thanks to Sonia Harris for our recording. Please note, this recording contains unedited language of an adult nature. We're presenting our podcast version here. To listen to the full event, go to kuow.org/speakersforum.
My name is K.O. Nikita Oliver, and I was asked to do a specific poem for y'all, and before I do it, I just want to give you a little bit of background of where it birds out of, and especially as we think about a city like Detroit, and we think about places like Standing Rock and the Navajo Nation Reservation, where water is hard to find. It's there, it's polluted. And just remembering that water is not just a human right, but when we think about what Miniwichoni means, which is, I will say it one more time, Miniwichoni. We really have to think about how water moves. It's not just that it is life for us, but water moves in a very particular way. And when I was at Standing Rock, and when I reflect upon time that I myself spent in Detroit, because that's where my family always had our family reunions, thinking about Flint, Michigan, Standing Rock, the Navajo Nation, places like Detroit, Indianapolis, Chicago, where I grew up, where you look at the car industry, you look at water as a human right, you look at housing in Seattle, and we wonder why our nation is at the point that it's at now. It's because we're thirsty. And when you're thirsty, when your body is thirsty, you will react in particular ways. You'll do what you have to get that water. You'll do what you have to live. And so I wrote this piece after Standing Rock, and wrote it as I thought about all the many movements that we're watching erupt across the country and have been watching for a long time, and what it really means for you and I to move like water, and for you and I to choose to be justice, especially in places where justice seems like it's dry. I grew up in the Black church, so this might take like 20 minutes. Y'all ain't ready. Let's go down to the river to pray, studying about those good old days, and who shall wear the golden crown. Good Lord, show me the way. Oh, family, let's go down. Let's go down. Don't you want to go down? Oh, family, let's go down, down to the river to pray. I can hear my auntie singing in the back of the chapel. My baba leans down to me and says, baby, understand that justice is like water. It starts as rain in the clouds and makes its way down the mountainside into the valley below, that it settles in the place where it is most needed. Understand, baby, you must be like water. You must be like justice. See how this water moves. Water will not be obstructed. It will move around, over, or through a thing if it has to. You, justice, must move around, over, or through a thing if you have to. We get to the water, and Baba says to me, understand, baby, that justice is just us being just us. that without us there is no justice, that without us there is no resistance, that without us this system persists in its defiance, dividing us further from the divinity that is our unity with Mother Earth, dividing us further from the divinity that is our unity with each other, dividing us further from the divinity that is our unity, our love. She reminds me that in this place, suddenly cash will rule everything around me. That's when all we see is property. Suddenly we're seen improperly as the man is steadily blocking my attempts to break free. There can't be no free trade agreements when black bodies are sold as stocks and bonds and jail cells sell out as politicians are building their wealth on these black and brown bodies, markedly marketed, targeted, murdered extrajudiciously with impunity, not just locally but globally. By the same hands who stole us from our homeland to work these lands, the same hands that'll feed us back to these lands, the same hands that'll try to sell us back our homelands overprocessed and overpriced till we become underfed. But yo, guess what? I come from a resilient people, a still living people, a still here people. We are still here people. In the land of the brave, the home of the slave. Shit, I keep getting that wrong. The land of the braves, and somewhere around us, I feel like someone is missing. The natives, is anyone looking for them? As the rivers run red round us with blood, is anyone looking for them? We don't ask so they never have to tell the truth. You know, I think it has something to do with these politics, blood-sucking politicians where the only thing redder than their fangs are their blood-stained hands. Look at them, elbow deep in the cookie jar. Why don't we just call it capitalism? Who pays the toll for this feudalism? While the 10% prosper, the rest of us rest to the bottom in chains and body bags to be buried much more than 6 feet deep under more fair trade agreements where the only thing fairly traded is our rage against this machine, a machine that will have you believe you will never have enough, you will never be enough, but yo, see, enough is enough is enough is enough is enough is enough when we say it's enough. Say it's enough. It's enough. There's always been enough when we were willing to share it. My Baba leans down to me once again. By the river and the valley where the water pools and the place where it's most needed, tells me to look at my own reflection, reminds me that justice is what love looks like in public, reminds me that if you cannot love yourself, you cannot be justice, so you must first learn to love yourself before justice is just us being just us. She reminds me I must learn to love myself like water, that it must move around, over, or through a thing. If it has to, my love cannot be obstructed. That's the only way that justice is just us being just us. She reminds me that when I find myself lost, when I cannot figure out where the love has gone, she sings. Let's go down to the river to pray, studying about those good old days and who shall wear the golden crown. Good Lord, show me the way. Oh, family, let's go down. Let's go down, don't you wanna go down? Oh, family, let's go down, down to the river to pray. Justice is just us being just us. Thank you, y'all.
How's everybody doing tonight? Nice. I'm a little bit teary right now because I was thinking about having Nikita speak before we have a conversation about the 50-year rebellion. And one thing you may not know is that Nikita, we're welcoming Nikita back to public life. She was running for mayor, and she's also an artist. And she happened to meet her campaign manager doing a program here at the library. So when she asked, we did a plaza program with a DJ and art making, and it was very fun. And when she asked, hey, could I do a poem before you start the program, I was thinking about Scott saying he wanted to have spoken word, and it seemed like an opportunity that I couldn't turn down. But I also was thinking that this is a place where we get to meet one another. and we get to think about community and what we can do together. And it's really not about our political affiliation, but it's about us making a wonderful city. Tonight's program, The 50-Year Rebellion, How the U.S. Political Crisis Began in Detroit, is part of a series that we have been doing all year round that's looking at the changing political climate of our country. So with that in mind, we're thrilled to have Seattle's local scholar and activist Scott Kitterschige here with our special guest, author and scholar Michael Hart. Tonight's conversation is one that we've been planning for a bit, but the context is 50 years ago, urban rebellions erupted in Detroit and cities across America as social movements advanced all over the world. With political debates centered on many of the same unresolved issues, race, war, policing, and civil rights, resistance has emerged as the key word for today's generation of activists. Tonight, Scott Kitterschige, author of The 50-Year Rebellion, and Michael Hart, author of Assembly, will analyze the structural crisis provoked by the 1960s rebellions and draw lessons from the past half century of social justice movement building. Scott is a professor of American and Ethnic Studies at the University of Washington, Bothell, and previously professor at the University of Michigan. He is the author, co-author, editor of four books: The Shifting Grounds of Race, Black and Japanese Americans in the Making of Multi-Ethnic Los Angeles, The Next American Revolution, Sustainable Activism for the 21st Century with Grace Lee Boggs, Exiled from Motown, A History of Japanese Americans in Detroit, and The 50-Year Rebellion, which will be on sale and you can get a signed copy tonight, thanks to Elliott Bay. Scott is also a board member of the James and Grace Lee Boggs Center to Nurture Community Leadership in Detroit. And hey, I love that. I love any crowd that's participatory. And has been involved with a range of community organizations since the 1960s. Hold your applause, because I'm going to introduce Michael Hart, and then we'll give them a really warm round of applause. Michael Hart teaches in the literature program at Duke University. He is co-author with Antonio Negri of the Empire Trilogy, Empire, Multitude, and Commonwealth, as well as Declaration and Assembly. The trilogy in particular, its first volume, Empire, has been hailed as the Communist Manifesto of the 21st century. I think these two might have an interesting conversation for us. So please welcome Michael and Scott.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for coming out tonight. I know there's a lot going on in the world, so it's really humbling that you're all here. I really want to thank Davida Ingram for that generous introduction and for all her work, not just on this program, but for so many amazing programs that make this library and make this city a much better place. Thank you so much for your work. And thank you to everyone at the library that makes events like this possible. Thank you to Elliott Bay. And thank you to Nikita Oliver for that amazing opening. I had this event that really was a bucket list event when my previous book with Gracie Boggs came out. It was in New York, and Grace was a really close friend of Ruby Dee. So Ruby Dee did a poem to open my last book launch. And I think in many ways, Nikita is carrying on that spirit of artists like Ruby Dee, who have been so active in the public arena. She's helped us to see that the movement is bigger than all of us, but that we can all become bigger by participating in that movement. So thank you, Nikita Oliver. And I want to thank Michael Hart for really helping me think through this book and continuing conversation that's been going on over a number of years now. I would be remiss if I didn't start by recognizing people that died and were injured in Charlottesville, but really everyone that struggled against the fascists, the Nazis, the white supremacists, and struggling for democracy and human rights and human dignity in this country, which is shouldn't have to be a struggle for basic human dignity, but it still is. And I want to see that activism as part of a long tradition of struggle. And I want to put that into the context of what David had talked about, the unresolved contradictions of 1967. I think we're still living in a historical moment framed by 1967. Sadly, as Michael said, we're still living in a moment framed by the unresolved contradictions of 1867. But we're going to focus more today on the past 50 years. And I want to just give two examples. I'm sure you've all heard them by now. Trump's both sides comment, in many ways, is shaped by the response to the 60s, by the idea that the push for racial equality and the establishment of civil rights means a loss of freedom for others in this country. This is really the product of 50 years of racial resentment and politicians consciously inflaming that racial resentment. I read a poll today that said 68% of Trump supporters believe, quote, there is a lot of discrimination against whites. And that is really the central problem for many of them and why he could say there are sort of legitimate concerns being raised by both sides, and we need to say fine people on both sides. And I think the second point is his focus, this equivocation defaulted to this focus on restoring law and order, which was, again, the predominant right-wing response to the rebellions of the 60s, the rebellions in the cities, but also, really, the revolt against the imperialist wars in Vietnam and other places around the world. That this shock to the system required a call for law and order. This is what Nixon ran on when he was elected in 68. And this was part of a real shift, a paradigm shift, from a focus in this country on a war on poverty to a focus on a war on crime and what we have now, this mass incarceration crisis. So this is really, again, a product of 50 years of a politics of fear and resentment in response to the crisis brought about by the rebellions of the 1960s. The focus on law and order in the 60s was revolved around, you know, the FBI's COINTEL program, coordinating assassination of not just Black Panther Party members, but other activists trying to convince Martin Luther King that he should commit suicide and give up leadership, and infiltrating or at least spying on just about every social movement in this country in the 60s. Today, we see attacks on democracy, we see authoritarianism, we see voter suppression. And again, this is part of this pattern of a 50-year response. So we live in very dangerous times. And I want to quote my mentor, Detroit's philosopher activist Grace Lee Boggs, from an address she made after her 98th birthday. She said, quote, "With growing unemployment, the crisis in the Mideast, and the decline in this country's global dominance, we have come to the end of the American dream. The situation reminds me of the 1930s, when good Germans, so-called good Germans, demoralized by their defeat in World War I, unemployment and inflation, followed Hitler into the Holocaust. These days in our country," she continued, "a growing number of white people feel that as they are becoming the minority and the black man has been elected president, the country is no longer theirs. They are becoming increasingly desperate and dangerous," end of quote. Now, it sounds like the pitch-perfect response to Trump's campaign in 2016. But actually, she was responding to events that happened in Detroit and Michigan in 2013, when the governor, Rick Snyder, stripped Detroit's elected government of its authority and named an emergency manager to take autocratic control over the entire city. The key elements that would later mark Trump's election facilitated the state takeover and bankruptcy of Detroit: authoritarian rule by the super wealthy, a so-called white lash against black political power, voter disenfranchisement, the gutting of workers' rights, and the pillaging of public goods and institutions. And the architects of this heavy-handed maneuver have subsequently put forward Detroit's corporate makeover as precedent for financially distressed governments and public entities across the globe. So the sad reality is that the hazards millions of Americans fear may happen in 2017 most likely have already struck Detroit. Detroit used to be the wealthiest city in America, by many assessments. It now has an official 40% poverty rate, a poverty rate that is triple the national average. During the 1950s, Detroit population peaked near 2 million. By 2015, it was estimated to be down to 677,000. And Detroit became a national symbol of extreme, persistent racial segregation and inequality. So these, to me, are not symptoms of one city, you know, that's exceptionally bad. These are symptoms of a structural crisis that is systemic and national in scope. And to borrow from critical race theorists Lonnie Guinier and Gerald Torres, we need to see Detroit as America's canary in the coal mine, to use their term. Too often it's been cast off as a space of exception, its problems so insurmountable that the nation refused to deal with them. However, Guinier and Torres call on us to recognize how embattled communities of color, quote, signal problems with the way we have structured power and privilege and provide the early warning signs of poison in the social atmosphere. So we'll get more into this, but I just want to lay out what are the things we can learn from Detroit. One is that Detroit helped us to see the distinction between calling an event a riot versus a rebellion. Right? So for those who saw it as a riot, it was a description of conditions that needed a restoration of law and order, and we've already seen where that's gone. But violence was not new in Detroit or in America. It was embedded within a white supremacist social order. Detroit itself one time had over 20,000 Klan members, right? People aren't aware of this. This is the 1920s when patterns of racial segregation and inequality are really being established in the industrial city. Detroit had a race riot in 1943, and race riot then meant white mobs and police assaulting African Americans. And this persistent pattern of job discrimination, inequality within the schools, within the housing, was in many ways enforced by unequal policing and frequent outbursts of police brutality. So that is why so many in Detroit gravitated towards seeing the uprising as a rebellion rather than a riot. The violence was always already inherent within the white supremacist order. But what we want to get more into today is what Grace Lee Boggs and others talked about, the need to move from rebellion as a stage in rejecting a system and an inequality towards social transformation and revolution. Seeing revolution not as one event that will simply change everything overnight, but seeing it as a protracted struggle that particularly has to arise from the grassroots. So I'm gonna stop there and save some of these specific discussions for a conversation that we'll have over the next 45 minutes or so.
So what Scott and I have planned is that we'd each talk for 5 to 7 minutes, I think, right at the beginning, and then we have three different points that we're gonna talk back and forth about before, I think the idea is more or less to open it up between 8 and 8:15 to have plenty of time for a discussion, just so you know where we're going with that. I wanted to emphasize and really to take off from where one of the points that Scott left off with, and that's the way I would put it is to say that protest is not enough. I mean, clearly today, protest is necessary. Not only in the U.S., it's sometimes easy to lose track of the fact that it's the rise of right-wing movements and governments isn't strictly a U.S. problem, but in some ways common with a variety of countries around the globe, including the Philippines, Turkey, Russia, Poland, movements in Western Europe too. So when keeping that in mind, I would say it's absolutely necessary to protest. It's absolutely necessary to protest in the streets, at police killings, at the courthouses when the police are not convicted, at the construction of tar sands pipelines, at the construction of and functioning of oil refineries, at the airports, responding to Muslim bans, in all kinds of ways, and of course against fascist racist demonstrations like in Charlottesville. In fact, you could construct your list with innumerable other necessary today points of protest. Yeah, I guess so the first point of this, I suppose, is that protest is necessary. I mean, the events of Charlottesville force us to add also that a kind of defensive action is also necessary today. Unfortunately, a kind of protecting people against fascist violence, especially when police are unable or unwilling to do so. When I think about other countries that I've been involved with similar kinds of things, in recent years there's been a similar kind of need to protect migrants. I'm thinking now of Germany, Sweden, Italy, countries that I know relatively well, protecting migrants against fascist attacks. Like, so there's a kind of defensive action, an anti-fascist defensive action, anti-racist defensive action that has to happen. But all that said, it seems to me that it's important always to keep in mind that protest isn't enough. When we only think about protest and only about these kind of defensive actions, it seems like we can be stumbling from one disaster to the next. In fact, since the election in November, and especially since the inauguration in January, it can seem people are tied to their Twitter feeds or tied to the news cycle so much that there's this kind of incessant reacting. And so that reacting and the defensive mechanisms can be all engrossing. Instead, and this is something that Saad already said, so I'm really just amplifying or repeating one point he made. Instead, in addition to protest, in addition to the defense, what's necessary is the construction of real social alternatives. And that's what I think we really have to focus on. I'm sure that later I have some examples, and Scott has some too, about what's going on today, where people are constructing real alternatives and not just being, not only being caught up in the kind of response and protest. But let me just add here, before we get to that later, I wanted to add, and in some ways try to link this to the story Scott was telling about Detroit, a general or theoretical hypothesis. I hope you can be indulgent of me, that's the way I think. So here's the hypothesis, and then I think I'll be able to make it articulate it better enough. The hypothesis is that resistance is prior to power. What I mean by this is we normally think of it in the opposite way. We normally think is that power acts, they innovate new ways to oppress people, etc. And what resistance does is it responds to it. Like that power comes first and resistance comes second. What I'd propose, or this seems to be a useful hypothesis, is to think about it the opposite way. That resistance is what comes first and power comes second. So let me just start with the story that Scott tells about Detroit in the book in particular. I've read the book, by the way. I highly recommend it. The story he tells in the book is about these 50 years in Detroit and how it's really a right-wing and capitalist response to rebellion that's driven those 50 years. Like that really 67 comes first and then fiscal crisis, white flight to the suburbs, financial control of the city is all in some ways a response to that. So that's maybe one way of thinking about it. But when we think about the rebellion, it's important not only to think about July 1967, fighting the police, the burning and looting, but rather to think about the history of Detroit in the decades around that, and the kinds of resistance that was really not so much resisting power, but creating alternatives already. It's really that, I would say, that the power in Detroit was responding to. So for me, important examples of this come from the auto industry, and maybe thinking Detroit in those years, it's impossible to separate the history of the city from the history of the auto industry. I'm thinking in particular of two specific organizations, which Scott does talk about, of course, and explain in the book, the Dodge Revolutionary Union Movement at the Dodge plant, the Dodge auto manufacturing plant, and related to it, the League of Revolutionary Black Workers. Both of these organizations, what I think was distinctive about them is that they were, of course, opposing the company. You know, they were workers who were struggling against Dodge or against the auto manufacturers, really against capital as a whole, but they were also struggling against the United Auto Workers, and in specific, the white centralized leadership of the UAW. So what these organizations were constructing at the time was a more democratic and specifically a more autonomous organization. Like more autonomous not only from capital or from the plant, but also from the union and specifically from the white controlled union. And they were also involved not only in the plant, like not only the organizations of workers in the factory, but also the organization of the community outside of the plant. Like ultimately, I think what these groups were aimed at and what they were constructing was an alternative mode of life, and specifically with these organizations, a black autonomous mode of life in Detroit. So it seems to me, to come back to my hypothesis then, that resistance is prior to power, that the development of the power structure in Detroit was responding not only, or really not even so much, to the conflict with the police in the street. You know, if you think about 1967 as that kind of, as the burning and looting, but rather to the kinds of resistance that was really constructing an alternative mode of life. Like that's what seems to me interesting, and what the League and the Dodge Revolutionary Union movement was doing. So that my hypothesis then, that resistance is prior to power, it's not just that it comes first, it's really that is the moment of innovation. Like that power is not able to construct. What is really these moments of resistance or struggle for liberation, like that's where the real moment of innovation is. And that's what it means to say that resistance is prior to power. That's the moment of innovation, and power just reacts to it and tries to contain it, steps back from it. So what does this do for us? So, like, what would this hypothesis or this perspective? Yeah, so looking at the history of the Detroit Rebellion that way, also now trying to read movements in the present that way, what does it do for us? One is to recognize that, and maybe this is the most simple one, or maybe too simple even to say, is that we're not just victims. Like, it's not just that power acts and we are victims of it, but rather that, or that we're just defending, or that we're just reactive in all those ways, but rather that social struggles for liberation are powerful authors of social innovation themselves. Like, that's what I mean by this perspective of resistance is prior to power. And it forces us to look beyond the protest to the instances of social innovation. Okay, so if that's I'm really gonna stop with this first part there, but I hope that you could see how it relates to my opening claim that we have to, and here again, I think I'm saying something that all of you, that seems to me no news for anyone, you know, that protest is not enough. That in addition to protest, we need also, and maybe more importantly, to construct real lasting alternatives, that this notion of resistance being prior to power is a way of seeing that, or a way of highlighting that, that it's not just a matter of resisting, of reacting, of defending ourselves against oppression, but also and moreover about treating the struggles as the moment of innovation that can create social alternatives. And that's what we need to focus on today, it seems to me. Okay, I'll pass to the next part, Scott.
Thanks. So in this back and forth part, we decided we wanted to start by looking at the significance of 1967, right? So I'll say a couple of things about that, and that relate not just to Detroit, but really to Seattle and really everywhere in the US. The one obvious point is that the contradictions of 1967 have not been resolved. We still have white supremacists. We still have a system of institutional racism and white supremacy beyond people out there carrying torches. We still have severe economic inequality. People were protesting wars in the 1960s. We're still quagmired in at least two wars and possibly, you know, worried about a nuclear war at this moment. And undoubtedly, it was police brutality that touched off the rebellion in Detroit and in Newark and other places in the 60s. Most of the people that died in Detroit were killed by the police, right? So we can look at it as an uprising, but really it was also a police riot. This new movie, Detroit, which some people like and others don't like at all, does get at a very important incident that happened, where it was basically the police in the middle of the Detroit Rebellion assaulting, torturing, and really massacring innocent African-American civilians and two white women in a motel. So that's an important thing to point out, is in some ways that hasn't changed. Seattle, we're still dealing with police killings and trying to get them under control. I think the other side of that, though, is that 1967, even though some of these forms of oppression still exist, really is a turning point in history. Because, as Michael was saying, so much of the politics of the last 50 years has been a reaction to the shock to the system that the rebellions of the 60s represented. The rebellions in terms of the street uprisings, but also, again, the political revolt against the existing order and against a system that preached equality, but was really very slowly and gradually moving in that direction, and in many ways was starting to stall. And so, you know, what you see in Detroit was black political empowerment to the point where you had 40 years of African-American mayors, right? And the response to that was more white flight, more shifting of resources and jobs and funding to the suburbs. And you had this new base, white voters moving from the Democratic to the Republican Party, the so-called Reagan Democrats, and now some of them supported Trump. So it was a turning point in terms of this right-wing counter-revolution. But it was also a turning point in terms of oppressed peoples, communities of color, and other formerly marginalized and silenced voices saying that, you know, we are going to put our issues at the center of the national stage, right? And in many ways, that is what is the source of polarization in this country today. It'd be, you know, easy to say, why can't we all just get along? Well, the point is, the reason we don't get along is because we haven't resolved these issues that, again, grew out of the rebellions of the 1960s. So, Michael.
So I had just two ideas about this historical part. To go with this, and they both do, in some ways, have to do with the Catherine Bigelow film, too, which I imagine some of you have seen, and, okay, most of you haven't seen. You don't have to have seen it, and maybe you don't have to see it. I have relatively low expectations of what Hollywood would do with such an event, so I wasn't disappointed by it. But I thought two criticisms of it might help, you know, just as framing devices, and one about police brutality and the other about spontaneity. The police brutality point maybe is a simple one, and it's partly about reading the events. It seems to me that while one must focus on police brutality and on police killings, as we often do still, and of course, as a representation of Detroit also does, it can be misleading because that focus on police brutality, or even the concept itself, presents it as an exception. I think that it seems as if, you know, this is the kind of impression one can get from a film such as that, but also I think our recounting of many of the events of the last decade, it can seem as if, therefore, if we only had a police force that did not include those few racists, everything would be better. If it seems like the exception, that's what I think the concept of police brutality too often does. And instead, one has to recognize not the exception, but the normal, daily, vicious life of relationships to the police, to the courts, to the prison system. Like, the one has to focus on the norm, not on the exception. So that's what the only difficulty I'm having then, or the only criticism I'm using here of this notion of police brutality, is that it focuses on the exception, whereas I think the real problem is the norm. what really is happening every day, that's the problem, rather than the exception. The second, maybe I could put this again as it seemed convenient to put as a criticism of the film too, is about this appearance of spontaneity. Like that it appears, and it could easily appear, that the rebellion was a spontaneous response to the police killings, the police arrests, first at an unauthorized bar, you know, of liquor sales, and then the police violence. I think my motto with this would be, don't trust anyone who calls a movement or a revolt spontaneous. I think that it only looks spontaneous from those who are ignorant of the causes. So, I mean, the classic example is this, and I think you can probably think of many other classic examples. A classic example comes to mind for me is 1960 in Greensboro, four young black men sit at a white lunch counter and refuse to leave. So journalists and many sympathetic observers described it as a spontaneous protest. And from the outside, it certainly appeared to come from nowhere. But then, of course, if you know what was going on behind those four young men, the organization for years in church groups, in student groups, the local chapters of the NAACP, there had been, for years before that, sit-ins elsewhere in the Southeast in the US, so that it only appeared spontaneous if you didn't see all of this. I think spontaneity just is that, is the appearance from the outside, whereas from the inside, one can recognize the long construction that goes into this. I mean, one could name a number of other, numerous other events. I mean, another one that I've been interested in, the 2011 riots in London after the Mark Duggan killing. I mean, I guess this is what I think that Scott, the importance that Scott attaches to the distinction between a riot and a rebellion. Whereas a riot could appear spontaneous, whereas a rebellion has behind it a history of organized struggles. At least that's the way I'm interpreting it. So the spontaneity, it seems to me, like in the same way that I think police brutality reduces the normal and structural functioning, especially racist functionings of the police, the courts, and the prison system, spontaneity is also a way of discrediting the revolt and focusing on it merely as a reaction and not as a constitution of alternatives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I want to take off from your point about the repression and the police brutality not being an exception, but really being the norm. Not that they have to do it, just like the Klan. As Jimmy Boggs used to say, the Klan would, you know, lynch people, not continuously, but they would do it enough to where the rest of the time that threat and that fear would be imposed upon, right, the black community under Jim Crow. And I guess I get that that's what you're saying about, you know, the state violence, right? That it happens as a way to enforce order, right? And it seems to me that one of the things that comes out of the rebellions of the 60s is this shift towards authoritarianism, mass incarceration as a way to restore order. But it's interesting to me that, you know, obviously liberals and Trump supporters don't agree on almost anything right now. But there is among some liberals this kind of common sentiment to try to go back to a golden age of American politics, of American liberalism, when you had the New Deal and you had a social safety net. And again, that's not all, but it is certainly some. You see it in the writings of someone like a Paul Krugman. And obviously when Trump supporters are saying, make America great again, you know, they are talking about a return to a sense of prosperity and peace. And they are covering over all the male privilege, the white privilege, the heteronormative privilege, the cisgender privilege that was inherent in that, right? Which is, but in some ways, so are the liberals thinking that we can just go back to an era of New Deal liberalism, right? I mean, in fact, the point of the 60s rebellions was New Deal liberalism was not serving everybody equally. In fact, Ira Katznelson just read an editorial in the New York Times based on his book, When Affirmative Action Was White. So many of these 20th century programs of the New Deal and of liberalism and coming out of the Democrats disproportionately uplifted whites in the middle class rather than immigrants, people of color, particularly African Americans and women. And I think that's one thing that why the 60s is a point of no return, because you really have to be innocent and naive to think that, you know, there was some happy medium at that moment. And so that's where I see the polarization happening, where you have this shift towards authoritarianism and right-wing authoritarianism in terms of state violence, but also this shift towards, you know, gutting unions and pensions and benefits and using globalization and outsourcing as weapons against workers. That devastates Detroit, even while other cities like Seattle may benefit from the new global economy. And yet, even when cities are more wealthy, you have some of the same problems. So in Detroit, you have 140,000 foreclosures because people's property values are devastated by predatory lending and Wall Street shenanigans and other things. But in Seattle, because property values have skyrocketed, you also see people losing their homes and communities under attack. In Detroit, the public school system has basically been eviscerated heavily by the funding and involvement of Betsy DeVos, who's now, you know, attempting to replicate these types of privatization policies for the whole country. And yet in Seattle, you don't get that same level of white flight from the public school system, but because of that, you have much more race and class inequality within the Seattle school district. I guess the point I'm getting at is the polarization happens really everywhere, even though it looks like it's more extreme in a place like Detroit. But I was getting at your point that the system itself, right, there's no such thing as a normal system. In fact, what we call the exceptions are really defining the new dynamics of the system. So I guess that, brings us more to the present. So I want to give a sense of really some of what's happened in Detroit. And I think, again, it's important to point out that Detroit was really at the center of the fight for workers' rights, labor unions, and civil rights in this country, right? Detroit was even called a model city for social progress prior to 1967. And what we've seen is it's really not an accident that Detroit has been targeted for this right-wing, authoritarian, autocratic takeover by a so-called emergency manager in the name of restoring, you know, fiscal health. But really what it is, it's not just a rearrangement of fiscal policies, it's a rearrangement of social policies on a mass scale. And so you see pensions and benefits cuts for workers and retirees, you see massive privatization of city departments, sell-off of public assets. There's even this plan that these libertarians have to buy up Belle Isle, which is like Detroit Central Park, but it's an island. They actually want to turn it into a private city state for millionaires. This is an actual proposal. And it's not just fringe people. It's like, you know, the former head of the Chamber of Commerce and the treasurer of the Republican Party, people like that. In terms of focusing on gentrification and making the city more business friendly, you have massive subsidies for billionaire developers like Mike Ilitch, but his family owns the Detroit Red Wings. They got a $285 million subsidy for a hockey arena while the city was in bankruptcy. Meanwhile, $250 million plus dollars that was supposed to go from the federal bailout to help homeowners facing foreclosure or, you know, they're having trouble with their mortgage payments was diverted instead by the emergency manager and the governor to demolitions. And if people didn't leave because their house was demolished, the city started shutting off water to over 80,000 people in the midst of this bankruptcy. And so it was basically, and while they were over a 15-year period, closing roughly 200 public schools. And maybe the only good thing about the water shutoffs is that at least people having their water shut off weren't getting poisoned by drinking water as the people in Flint, 100,000 people in Flint were when the emergency manager took over their city. So again, these are horror stories, but they are also an attempt to sort of take away the floor that once existed, right? To take away not just the safety net, but a basic sense of livability for people so that, again, a city could exist no longer on the basis of civil rights and union rights, but be based on this model where the billionaire developers rule over everything. They have their private security, you know, defining what life is like, and people who can't afford to live there are simply, you know, seeing their homes demolished, their schools closed, and their neighborhoods basically stripped of services. So that's, to me, what's really dangerous about this moment. Michael, I'm going to bring you back in here. Because the other point I think we want to make, and I definitely want to make, is that all these negative things that are happening, and again, you see what's happening in politics at the national level, these horror stories are a sign of a system that is producing tremendous amounts of oppression and inequality, but a sign of a system that's also in crisis, right? And I think that's really important to recognize today, that the system is in crisis because of the demands that movements have put on it and the challenges and the shock to the system that came, not just from, again, from the urban uprisings in places like Detroit, but from the 50 years of activism and organizing that the movements have done to create an alternative.
Thanks for streaming this episode of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Scott Kurashige and Michael Hart spoke at the Seattle Public Library Central Library on August 16th. Thank you again to Sonia Harris for our recording. You can hear the full recording on our website, kuow.org. Tune in again soon.